This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Coulter, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. We've gone full country today. The man considered to be the kiss of death at the FIFA World Cup, Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome, Coops.
Morning, all.
Yeah, Germany, you've got a bone to pick with you. And we have the woman that wears blue shorts to a baby shower when she knows they're expecting a girl, Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Yeah, I got nothing for that. And it could only be described as like a... like a hard blue too.
Oh, yeah.
Like it was.
There was no their pastel.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. That was, I just liked the shorts. But anyway, moving on. Thanks for having me.
So we did allude to the fact that the FIFA World Cup is going on at the moment, and it has been in some difficult hours to watch. Unfortunately, now that we've sort of whittled down some of the teams, the 2 a.m. kickoffs are not fantastic. But Coops, you have been heavily invested in this over the last couple of weeks. We did allude to the fact that you may have had money on Germany, who did not progress from the group stage, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Just looking at this, and it's something I want to sort of throw at you without notice in this space. The links, I suppose, between soccer and basketball, or football and basketball, whichever way you, whichever country you're coming from, football. I can do accents, not very well, it turns out. But is there a link between good basketballing countries and good soccer-playing countries?
It's a really interesting question, and I love it because it's got my brain going straight away. I think there is, and I think when you start pondering it, and as I am now, starting to think about how the nations use the strengths of the individual, and then it really does tend to reflect in the style of play of both their football teams and their basketball teams. Like I'm thinking about the African nations, and obviously, you know, incredible athletes, and they want to play with speed and they want to try and move around and kind of get you in an up and down game. And then thinking about, you know, the South Americans, even probably, you know, linked to the Spanish, you know, they want to use individual creativity and play with a little bit of flair. And then England kind of wants to bog you down a little bit, wants to play with a little bit of strength, wants to bully
starting
you.
Starting to get into the Test cricket nations, yeah, as well. That's the right. Pakistan, yeah, series at, yeah, the moment may not quite relate to that. But it is, like, there's got to be something to it. Like, we look at, and like Argentina is a great example. Messi, obviously, is renowned to be the greatest soccer player in the world. But Manu Ginobili, like both Argentinians, both play with incredible amounts of flair, space, time, understanding, from all accounts, great teammates at the same time. But there has to be some, and I suppose soccer aren't taking basketball type athletes. Like, they're not grabbing the 6'8", 6'9" athletes, because that's just not who plays soccer, I suppose. So maybe in those formative years, as the athletes are younger, that ability to play both sports, or that ability to maybe trial and error, learn a little bit more, it's the pickup. Like, I know, Zoe, you've spoken about it a fair bit, the ability for kids to just go and play pickup.
Yeah, I think when we're talking about this, I'm certainly not as... I enjoy watching soccer, and I enjoy soccer as a sport. I'm not anywhere near either of your level to be able to discuss the nuance of the sport.
My nuance stops at FIFA.
Bit of a Veep preference there. But one thing I would say when talking about something like this is... obviously, yes, pick up, when I talk about pick up basketball, go outside, just play one-on-one, play, you know, even five-on-five if you've got a group and just have no rules and, you know, go at it, figure some stuff out. There's a lot to learn. You see a lot of that in soccer because of the fact that all you need is a point of that's the goal and a ball. And that's it. And you can just play it. You can play it anywhere. So, you know, you see... footage of kids, particularly in other countries, that, you know, are just in the middle of a street, or they've just found some empty area and they're just playing soccer. But I think also there is a line between how basketball and soccer teach and scale. So soccer being huge for, and probably the leaders in scaling their sport for ages, to help with success and help with fundamentals and skill acquisition and enjoyment, the biggest one. You know, basketball just catching up to that at the moment. I think that probably has a bit to do with it, as well as the way that they teach. So soccer, again, probably the leaders in small-sided games and, you know, or games of purpose or whatever you want to call them, and teaching through play and teaching through decision-making. again, basketball catching up to that, I think is a big reason as to why there probably is a line drawn between those two sports.
It's such a great point. And then I think something else where we're a little bit behind is soccer not only scaling in terms of a better perspective on the pitch and how to create and so on, but for a long time they've actually shrunk the size of the playing area but kept more bodies in it. So they really challenged their athletes to be faster and make quicker decisions and be able to play in less space. Where we haven't really done that. Like, you know, we've gone a 3-on-3, which is great, especially for our younger athletes. But, you know, how much 6-on-6 are we playing in the half court? You know what I mean? Or 7-on-7?
You think we're getting more than, like, 7 kids turning up to practice? Like,
come on, very true. Play.
But there's, yeah, but I mean, thinking about, there's usually what, 8 teams training on one court, yeah, so you could probably get
one. One half court.
Yeah,
but it's a good point you make, though. I remember a couple of Spanish coaches we had out there. Was a clinic ran Basketball Victoria ran a clinic. They're out there, and they were running a drill that basically had a lot of kids in a real small area making layups and things, but all sort of one on top of the other. And I was sitting in the stand, sort of thinking, oh, this is uncomfortable. Someone's going to hurt themselves.
Yeah, there's a rolled ankle coming as they land on top of someone else.
But there's also a figure it out about that too. Figure out how to navigate through that without getting hurt. How do you find your space? How do you finish knowing that someone's bearing down on you? And, you know, and this wasn't a competitive drill. It wasn't a one-on-one or anything. It was literally just layups, but they were all in the same area. And it was, yeah, like I said, I felt uncomfortable, and I think that's probably something that needs to change. Obviously, we don't actively put our kids in danger, but...
Yeah, we're not setting up a basketball ring on Eastlink.
Yeah. Like,
there are lines here, but I mean, you make a valid point all the same, because there is... I feel like a lot of our kids look for that area of comfort, I suppose. Like, they want to train indoors on a polished floor with glass backboards, with spring-loaded rings, and it's like...
With a coach.
With a coach. It's like, hey, you know what? Let's go work it out a little bit. Like, go and find a way. Go and shoot in the rain. Like, what's the worst that can put... Like,
I'm not endorsing that
wholeheartedly, but, you know, it is like, go and find a way to sort of, not trial and error, but go and do something that's a little bit uncomfortable.
I've said a million times, and no disrespect to any of the wonderful coaches that I had, but as a junior athlete, the majority of my learnings came from playing one-on-one against my brothers in the backyard. Yep. Like, it was, I didn't learn more anywhere else than I did there, because I had to figure out how to go against bigger, faster, stronger, smarter, and more experienced. I had to find where, if I wanted to score, and there was no, like, the old days
you
of...
You have to put this foot there and that ball there.
But there was also no, oh, just let her score, right? Like, there was none of that. Like, I had to, if you wanted to score and you wanted to have a chance of winning... You had to figure it out. The only rule they put in for me is if I went left and shot left, they wouldn't block me. But if I went left and shot right, they'd block me. And so, like, I still attribute my two brothers as the two best coaches I've ever had, because the things they taught me, probably without even realizing, were huge. But it's out there with no rules. You know, you get that extra bump, you get that extra physicality, you know, you have to figure stuff out, and you have the time to figure it out because it is in a practice type environment. But, you know, it's not as structured or rigid or anything, and you can start to learn some things, what you can do, what you can't do, what you need to be better at, and think your way through a little bit more.
Yep. And I think we spoke about it last week as well. Soccer is one of the sports that translates into basketball really well.
Very much so.
Time and space, footwork, like just the scanning side of things in particular. Like, I know, Coops, you've spoken about it. There was a tweet that came out during the week about Messi's scanning against Poland, I think it was, which was just next level. You look at how many times he looks around before he's got the ball. I think it was up at like 640 something. And it's like...
Incredible. So good.
I get it. It's a 90-minute game. You get some time to do this in. But, geez, like, come on. It's that sort of stuff. So... Yeah, I think there's a bit we can take from it as well. Like, it's interesting to hear soccer now saying, look, we need more resources, we need more facilities, we need a dedicated training centre and all that sort of stuff. It's like, well, yeah, this is all stuff that basketball need too. Like, they're not in their own in that space. Yeah. And I think compared to probably the most, I suppose, followed sport in Australia, we all need resources in this way. There's nothing unique about this, but I think basketball is one of those sports that actually prepares you to play any other sport in comparison, whereas some of the others pretty much prepare you to play that sport only. Read into that what you will. You can probably cast your own dispersions into that. So we are into part two of the mailbag for this week.
The mail's here. Here's the mail that never fails. It makes me want to wag my tail. When it comes, I want a whale mail.
So for the coach that requested more pop culture references on the podcast, you're welcome. So this is our last episode for season eight. You are very much welcome to go back over the summer months and listen to some of the old episodes that we've had in there. Provided Twitter is still a thing when we come back, you can probably try and reach out on that as well. How do they get you, Coops?
At Coach NCB.
Zoe?
At ZoeCar85.
And I'm at Rob Coulter. If you need us, you can obviously use the hashtag TalkingSplit as well, and we'll try and pick it up from there. So once again, we did some of these questions last week. We've got the next lot coming through this week. There is one question we had last week, Coops, that we want your opinion on as well. And we'll
Coops,
test you're
going to love.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great.
Most hated drills that you see at practice sessions.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Horseshoe shooting.
Yep.
Is just, it just drives me mental. It's like nails on a chalkboard. You're practicing a shot that you may get like once a season in terms of a baseline out of bounds pass, easy score. Like, just doesn't, it just is not game relevant, and it just drives me mental. Tennessee shooting drill, three man weave, five man weave. I've got more. I think I'm just hung up. I'm just hung up on the horseshoe shooting right now. It's
at any stage,
like
wave at us during this podcast, and we'll come back to you.
Okay,
you think of more. Like, so oddly enough, they're the ones that we came with as well. I did have a coach reach out during the week and said, "Oh, look, we heard you say you don't like three man weaves. What about five man weaves?" No, same answer. Still don't like them. Same problem.
And unless you run a distinctive break where you pass and cut behind that person to create some sort of shape. And now, if you're doing that, awesome. Love the creativity.
Relevant.
Yeah, awesome. But it's not relevant.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't connect to the game. You are wasting time doing it. You can find better ways to work on transition passing, transition spacing, you know, all the things that you obviously want to get out of those. But I'm sure I'll find another couple before.
So in case you go down that path, Titan shooting was the other one. Like those three lines across the foul line, shoot it, rebound yours, pitch it back, run to half court, jump in the end of a line was the other one that we threw out there.
Yeah, that one I don't mind as much if there's real purpose to basically using it as a technique-based activity. Because you got a lot of kids and it's like, you know, we do need to do some form-based stuff, but I don't want a lot of guys kind of, you know, guys and girls standing around. So I think if you structured it the right way and everybody had some real purpose, yes. But if you're just doing that because that's the easiest way for you to think that you can
get bulk shots,
then again, they're not.
He's not going to like the last one. Tip drill.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, story time.
Oh, there's one more that you've missed.
When I was in college in the States, which I still have like PTSD from, it's one of the reasons I coach now. And one of the reasons I like to think that I'm a good coach is because I'm anti what happened to me in college. But my college coaches had a philosophy that they would try and drive us into the ground, like get us to the point where we could hardly stand up, and then we would practice basketball. So it'd be at least an hour and a half of drills just to get us tired, and then we would start playing. And like in their mind, that was reflecting being able to play well in the fourth quarter. What they didn't realize was like we just hated it, absolutely hated it. And one of the drills we used to do was the tip drill, and they put 2 minutes on the clock. The coach stood at the other end of the stadium. We'd have to tip the ball off the backboard, run around the coach. If you grazed his T-shirt, start again.
Oh.
And he kept walking back and back. And then if you missed a tip, start again. And then when the buzzer went, the next player had to put the ball in the hole. And if he missed the layup, start again.
Wow.
Cold.
Yeah.
Cold.
Yep.
So we're not going to be seeing this at All-State Camp next year. It's a fairly safe bet. Please stay away from that drill, coaches.
Yes,
it's not helping you.
The last one was four corner passing.
Yeah, again, like if you got younger groups and you're trying to get everybody moving, maybe, and there was a specific pass and pivot you wanted to work on, no more than a minute. But again, everybody would need to know exactly why you're doing it and what you're trying to get out of it. But I could think of 10 better game-based approach passing activities, like just playing 4-on-4, no dribble.
I'm going to give you one. Over the last week or so, I attended the Australasian Skill Acquisition Network Conference, ASAN. Yeah, I think I've got that right. So one of the presenters there was from New Zealand, came in and gave her take on four-corner passing drill. Now, they used the netball example for this, effectively. So what they found is that a lot of their teams were doing that four-corner passing drill. It was fine as part of their game warm-up, no issues with that. But what they found was when they used two people in the middle of that four-corner drill as defenders and they made all the players make a move before they would cut, the relevant game repetitions went up fairly significantly. So this is one area I would stress to coaches. If you are a proponent of, you know, tip drill, a bad example to be fair, but if you do like using one of these drills, that's fine, but try and modify it to get more out of it. Because in that situation, I walked out of that thing, actually, four-corner passing maybe isn't as bad as I thought it was. Maybe there is something that we can do with it. And it was because it was a warm-up drill, it was about the change of direction stuff. Can I set my player up to go one way before I come to another way? Do I now have to make a pass that's just timely because there's now defense involved in it? So it was actually a really interesting thing. And to be fair, one I hadn't considered. Mm. So, yes, there is a way to get it in there that you might want to use, but just think outside the box a little bit with some of the drills you are using in this space too.
Yeah, Tom Gallup sent me a link on Twitter that had a report about the Rondo, which obviously just coming back to soccer, but that was definitely an activity I've stolen from soccer to use in basketball. And for anyone who doesn't know, it's basically like a keepings off. You know, we put four players around the key, two defenders in the middle. Everybody's done a version, pig in the middle, you know, 2v1, that kind of thing. And it was interesting reading that article and talking about just adding a goal or adding a player in the middle of the rondo, or if you pass, then you had to move. You know, just that extra layer was just enough to completely change the dynamic of the activity and make it so much more game relevant and really pull the athletes up to that level of scanning and passing and all the things that we wanted to be working on, rather than just kind of going through the motions drill.
Well, and what's interesting, same conference, and they were talking about at around about 75% of the player's maximum thought process is about where you want them, because 75%, they'll still try, they'll still experiment, they'll still trial and error. If it becomes 90% of their mental capacity, that's when it falls off the cliff a little bit. They don't like doing it, they don't enjoy it anymore, it's too challenging for them. So you've got to give them a level of success that they can achieve within a drill or within a concept as well. Otherwise, if it's too hard, they're just going to give up and go, nah, I'm out. Like, I'm not up for this anymore. So you do have to be a little bit mindful too. So can you scale it? Putting one defender in might be enough. Putting two defenders in, now you're starting to get to a point where limited time and space, make decisions quicker, those types of things. So it is interesting as to how you can modify something you already do to try and get a better outcome just by small little changes along the way.
I really hope coaches go back and listen to that, Rob. Like, that's such an important part of their session planning, and thinking in depth about the kind of activities that they're trying to work on, and what's the context and how does it flow within my structure. It's not just, I've got to work on passing today, that's a passing drill, and, you know, I'm slapping together a session plan, you know, that I can just kind of get through. You know, go back, coaches, listen to that, think about that 75% and really challenge your athletes.
One of the questions we had come in: how do you deal with an obnoxious coach down the other end of the court? Zoe, do you want this one first?
Sure. It's tough, because what those sort of coaches do is tend to try and drag you in, and you've got to do everything you can to stay away from it. It's one, I think on our do's and don'ts we said,
yeah,
don't,
it's definitely one.
Don't engage other coaches, don't, you know, get involved if a coach is talking to a ref or something like that, don't get involved. You know, not everyone listens to the pod, so we can't reach everybody. But, it's really tough. I think one of the things is eventually, it sounds a bit schoolyard, I guess, but you ignore them long enough, they'll leave you alone. So when they do try to engage you, don't look, don't react, don't listen, don't do anything. When they jump in, if you are having a discussion with a referee or someone like that, you know, just don't respond. And it's hard. It is hard because you just want to turn around and tell them to shut up. But the longer you ignore them, the more they're going to realize that they're not getting to you, which is what they're ultimately trying to do. The hardest part is getting your athletes on board with that, because if they can't get you, they'll try and get them. And that's really tough. That's, you know, making sure that they understand why somebody is doing that, and the whole, I guess, operation of, they have generally coaches that do this, and I'm happy to be proven wrong on this, but generally coaches that do this sort of stuff are bad coaches. And I try not to speak like that, but that is generally what it is. They have no way of tactically or technically or any way of getting to you or beating you as a team or as a coach, so they resort to this. So it's one of those things that, you know, you just got to try and be the bigger person and stay away. One of the things you can do as much as possible is stay, if you're a walker, just stay away from the bench, like the score bench side, you know, so it's harder for them to get to you. Obviously, that's not always possible, but staying away from them and just ignore them and remembering and getting your players to remember why this is happening, and it's mainly because they're not as good as you or your team, is really, really important, and it may take some reminding.
Yeah, and it's not as, because you don't want to put the other person down either. Like, no. And that's the hard part, is that, you know, let's face it, there are coaches out there that all of us don't like for various reasons, and they're not necessarily the same person. Like, for various reasons over others, we just don't get along with them, or whatever the case may be. We don't like the way they coach, or whatever the case may be. Doesn't mean that we show them a lack of respect. So you still have to respect the opposition, even if you don't necessarily like the opposition in that space. So you do have to be a bit careful that, whilst you're saying ignore them, and it's the right message, I wholeheartedly believe it's the right message, you don't want to put them down to your players, because that's a really bad message to send to your players as well. Like, Coops, have you had any experience in this space?
Yeah, lots. Lots.
College. Yeah. Like, we're going back over this again.
No, yeah, like coaching against coaches like that, playing against coaches like that. And I think Zoe is spot on. And, you know, just to double down, you know, they're operating from a place of fear. You know, that they understand that they're not going to be able to compete at that level. Probably got a bit of imposter syndrome floating around in their head. And this is how they deal with that. And I think understanding that concept and sharing with your players, I think, is wonderful. I think that's a really important part. And then it's the role modeling and the accountability to your athletes around controlling the controllable. You know, we're not in control of how that coach behaves. We're only in control of how we are. Let's focus on that. And then obviously you as the coach need to make sure you're demonstrating that. And just something for the coaches out there, because it kind of falls in this category. Something has really changed my life in the last couple of years. I know you guys are getting sick of me talking about it away from the mic, but is stoicism. I would highly, highly recommend getting into stoicism in terms of the philosophy and the strategies that they have around, you know, how you conduct yourself and how you deal with adversity and those sorts of things. It's really helped me as a person and helped me as a coach. So that's, yeah, something there for coaches to explore.
Don't disagree with you at all. Like, it is a really interesting space. Even if you don't wholeheartedly believe in all of it or anything like that, it is just something that can maybe shift your mindset a little bit. Something that you can relate back to at times. Like, I think there's a lot of value in that as well. And I mean, we're not going to we may end up doing it, but we're not going to go down the mental health side of things. But it is actually really valuable from a mental perspective too, to how you function, what's good for you, what's not good for you, just that awareness and those types of things too. So it is always a really interesting path for coaches to go down. All right, question number two. If you're against structured pressures in youth levels, so we're talking like 12s and 14s, what can you do defensively that can similarly disrupt teams? Coops, what do you got?
Are they basically asking us how to press without pressing?
I think
or
so.
Or zone without zoning.
Yeah, I get that impression.
Well, it should just start with full court man-to-man. If you're really good in that space, you would be able to disrupt at that level probably more than you think. So spending time in defensive transition, spending time in, you know, really good full court ball containment, great off-ball full court positioning, you know, talking, taking up space, active hands, you know, is really where most of the work should be done. You can build in some things like face guarding the inbounder. So that's just a small strategy there to probably add a little bit more disruption. And then the other one, if you wanted to get a little bit more advanced, and I'm hesitant to say it because, you know, again, it should really be about the fundamentals at that age, would be to run and jump. Yep. And obviously that's a man-based press or trapping tactic that allows you to, most importantly, put the decision back on the athlete around when to run and jump, when to shoot a gap. And again, those decisions are what's going to create the best athlete going forward. So if you really want to do it, that would be my advice.
I have no issues with running and jumping in under 12s. Like, I know I used to teach it when I was doing under 12 stuff, and in very similar reason. It teaches them when to go, when to stay, teaches them how to communicate a little bit better. Like, yep. I actually like the idea behind it. And, of course, you're going to give up some points. But if you press, you're probably going to give up some points anyway. The best bit of that whole run and jump mentality was actually, like, the tip from behind stuff.
Yeah.
Like, the start on the baseline, offense in front, they take off, defense has to try and catch up and tip the ball away. I love that drill. It's great fun for a start. You can give people points if they get it and that sort of stuff. But it also teaches them to just go chase. Like, it's not a case of they've got past me, I'm done now, I can't possibly get into it, but it's that whole tip up, like, not swipe down, but tip up and out and try and deflect the ball. I actually really like that sort of stuff. So I agree completely in that you can teach everything out of that 1v1 concept, but just in an extended area. What about you, Zoe? Is there anything you say?
Well, no different. Like, Coops has hit the nail on the head from a full court perspective. I think if you're looking to challenge your team and mix things up a bit, and you're in that sort of probably under 14s because it's probably too advanced for them. But anyway, you can challenge them in a way of, because you can't go to a zone, for example, because things are show man, play zone, show zone, play man, you know, two passes, drop into the, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's not at your disposal. But things like, if the ball was to come down the right-hand side of the floor, you're going to switch everything. If the ball was to come down the left-hand side of the floor, now you're going to fight over and stay with. You're going to make mistakes.
Yeah,
it's going to make errors, yep. But it's going to teach kids how to think. And it's really going to challenge them. And the offense is going to be, what exactly are they in? You know, like, and they're going to be spending all their time trying to figure that out. So it can, you will bleed points early in it, but when they start to get it and understand it, it can be a really good tool to sort of start teaching that IQ, teaching that communication, because it's really important, teaching that to actually force the offense to pin them to a sideline, because if you allow them to dribble down the middle, now what are we in? You know, so it's really, really important, I guess, in a way, if you are looking to challenge and mix it up a little bit.
I suppose the hard part too is, as the coach, not giving up the answer for the other team as well, because they're going to screw it up. And it's like, you know, remember on the left side, we're supposed to be switching. It's like, okay, my bad.
Answer.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. So you want to, again, check for the knowledge through questioning.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to be in on the left? Yep. Like, that sort of thing is an easy way to get it done. But I like where they're going with it, but just please don't arrow press. Like,
that's, yes.
You know, the story remains the same in that space, but it just is how it is. So Zoe, how long would you persist with an offensive or defensive structure not working before you shelve it completely?
Oh, wow. If I'm with a senior team, I probably wouldn't shelve it completely. I'd probably just adjust it. Mm-hmm. Actually, even with a junior team. I think if you've spent time teaching it properly, then shelving something, you've just wasted all of that time. So why isn't it working? Is it not working because we're not getting open on the wing? Does that mean I need to put maybe a pin down in there to make that easier? Is that a personnel thing? Is it that the wrong person is in the wrong spot more often than not? So does that mean I need to change, maybe make adjustments to my transition running to make sure that that person's not in that position? Yeah, I would just look at making adjustments and tweaking it rather than throwing it. It doesn't mean you can't add things,
I think, but you need to be really careful about loading up on offenses. You know, I'm just going to add this, I'm just going to add this, I'm just going to add this, because you'll end up with a playbook thicker than the Bible running nothing well, where you could just have, you know, two or three sets that you run, you know, at an elite level. You're going to be more successful with those. So that really does come down to your planning for your season. What sort of athletes are you going to have? What sort of coach are you? Are you picking – this is probably going off on a major tangent, but are you picking a team for your offense, then setting your offense – or are you picking the best kids and then are you setting your offense to that? I would say go the latter, pick the best kids and then set your offense. Now, what do we need in that offense? What offenses have I seen or actions have I seen that, you know, I could put in that I like that could get A, B, C, D, you know, good looks where they want it, when they need it? And then if it's not working, then, yeah, it's just what tweaks can I make to it? Because, yeah, if you've spent months, especially like in preseason or something like that, on an offense, throwing that out has just wasted everybody's time.
Coops, what about you?
Yeah, very similar. Also, too, for the coaches that are at associations that may have a style of play or system of play. So, you know, having a chat with your DOC around, okay, well, we pick the best kids, but we have a kind of structured system. You know, how do they fit into that? And then what are some of those kind of layers, those wrinkles, those counters that Zoe's talking about that we can put into that? Again, you know, two really good counters is way better than having a whole nother set, because it's the same alignment. You know, you can be way more hands-on about where the ball is going and whose hands is it getting into. So, yeah, it just really is, you know, just piggybacking on the back of what Zoe's saying around, you know, what are the adjustments I can make before I, you know, throw the whole thing out and try and start again. The other part too is, especially with younger teams, is what's my shot quality like? So are we getting great shots but we're not making them? So then is it, okay, well, let's just stay with this. Like, yeah, we may lose tonight. You know, this may be a tough one, but we're generating the shots that we've spoken about, you know, for weeks or months or however long we've been playing. You know, now the adjustment is, okay, well, we've got to get back on the practice floor and, you know, and be better in our shooting.
Practice
and maybe
the shots.
Practice those shots, exactly. Rather than just in that moment be like, oh, I've got to get out of this. So I'm going to shelve it and, you know, and run horns.
And that's such a good point, though, about your shot quality and then getting in and practicing those shots. There's your warm-up.
Yeah.
You know, like
hang on, no turnout? Yeah.
No turnout. No horseshoe. But that could be your warm-up. You know, you get on real quick, just a real quick hit of first team to 10 of whatever, if your shot is coming off a pin down at the point, catch and shoot.
Yep.
Well, first team to 10, bang, get into it straight away. You know, get some moving, get shots up, practicing something. So you're not actually carving out 20 minutes to work on that stuff. You're just straight into it. And obviously then athletes being aware that they're the shots that they need to be practicing in their own time.
So you mentioned it, Zoe, and you kind of doubled down on it, Coops. Like, why isn't it working? Like, finding out what exactly isn't working. So, Coops, when you're teaching an offense for the first time, for example, would you put in different, say, entries, for example? So if you're a wing entry off a pass to start off with, would you show them, hey, look, if this is denied, we want to dribble enter on this? Well, like, would you show them that from the start, or would you wait and see how that goes? Because the risk, I suppose, of not giving them that is that you never get into the offense because that wing catch is potentially denied and they sit there and go, this offense sucks. But the risk of showing them that is too much. So where's the balance between the two?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a wait and see coach because I want to give the athletes time to figure it out.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe they can come up with something even better than I could that they're more comfortable in and that they're going to have more success in. I think the counter, especially in that teaching phase at practice, kind of evolves as your defense starts to cheat. Right, so we're playing against each other. We know what we're doing. The defense is like, you know, after maybe a few sessions is like, oh, okay, they've got to go here to start the play. So I'm going to deny it, even though we're not a denial team, whatever it may be. And then it's like, okay, guys, now we're having some trouble. Let's add this, you know, shake things up, and obviously you can go from there.
Yep. any different in the senior space, Zoe? Do you just throw it all at them and say, you should know this by now?
No, no, definitely not. I set them up to figure it out themselves. So exactly what Coops is saying, it probably doesn't take as long in the senior space. It's probably within the same session they start to cheat.
Just casually walk into a timeout as they're sort of split. And coaches can do this. Like if your teams are huddling, just walk into one of the huddles and say, hey, I want you to deny this first catch.
Yeah.
And just see what they do.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see what they come up with, but it's also a really good time to be able to test just their basketball IQ in general. So you're being denied, what should you do? You know, and they all go, backcourt. Like, well, you know it. Why aren't you doing it? But, you know, those sort of things then allow us to be able to see what sort of level they're at from a basketball IQ perspective. Do I need to hand this to you or can you figure it out? Mm. If you can, because I want you to figure it out, because if you can, you're more likely to do it in an instant in a game. Whereas if I tell you, you've got to read it, process it, then make the decision to do it. So, yeah, I like setting them up to sort of fail a little bit and then figure and then build it up from there.
That's where the learning comes from. Like, I don't think that's a bad thing, just like letting them work it out for themselves, which does lead to our next question. It's a very good segue you've got in there. So, Coops, how do you balance intervening as a coach versus letting them work it out? Like, how do you – because we all want our players to kind of work it out, but we also want to coach. How do you find the balance between the two when you're teaching something for the first time, whether it be a concept, a skill, or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, it depends. Depends on what you're teaching. Depends on how crucial the learning is to moving forward at that time. So it's a little bit organic. Just from personal experience, one of the things I've been doing recently is some forced interleaving in practice segments. So teaching a concept, giving the athletes some time to kind of figure it out, get some reps, then a forced shooting activity. So we go away and that's the process of forgetting. So we take 2 or 3 minutes to go get some shots, to allow them to forget what we just did, and then bring them back. And then I would have an athlete reteach to the group. I would preface it with a cold call saying, hey guys, you better be watching this because I may pick on any one of you to come out. So hopefully that engages a little bit more when I am demonstrating. But then, and then using the athletes to do that. Now, if we're Thursday night senior team and I'm trying to put something in and I know I've got to nail it down and maybe I'm a little low on time, you know, maybe I'm making a different choice there around, okay, I'm going to be really hands-on here. I'm probably going to stop it more. We're going to teach. We're going to do it that way. But if I have the opportunity to force interleave, have peer-to-peer coaching, act more as a facilitator around peer-to-peer coaching, so rather than me stop it, you know, go do a flyby you know, with an athlete and say, hey, wasn't, you know, Jimmy supposed to back cut there? Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, you should probably let them know about that. And, you know, can we do this thing a different way rather than just the traditional, okay, I've got to walk on the floor, stop it, talk for 2 minutes, go back. So, yeah, depends when where. There's some different strategies you can use. If there's coaches that want to talk a little bit more in depth, because I could keep going and talk about, like, all the scenarios and – and get really nerdy on it. So if there's coaches I want to talk a little bit more, yeah, please reach out.
Yeah, and there is, I mean, all the information tells us that the recall part and how long something will stick with us is they need to go away and forget about it, then come back to it, and that actually reinforces the memory as to how they come
100%,
back.
100%,
so yeah. It is a valuable skill that you don't just want to do all your shooting sessions at the start where you're teaching shot technique, for example, and that's it. Like, come back to it again during the same session. Like, Zoe, you obviously design a lot of session plans as part of your role here. Is that something you take into account, is when you need to teach and when you need to not shut up, but sort of let them work it out for themselves?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult because, like you said, we all want to coach. So throwing them the keys a little bit can be uncomfortable. But other than everything Coops has just said, flight path coaching or sniper coaching, whatever word you want to use for it, is really important. So when they're out, just a real quick hit and then walk away, go coach someone else, But if I generally find that the same error is happening, you know, 3 to 5 times without it being fixed after the flight path, then we probably need to stop it and say, okay, here's an error. And but it's all through questioning again. It's not, this is what you're doing wrong and this is how you fix it. It's, okay, we continue to turn the ball over when we're trying to make this entry pass. Why? And then they tell me and I said, okay, so what's the answer to that? And then someone will tell me and then I just step away and let them start again. It's, again, it's difficult because we want to just sometimes say, oh, for the love of good God, like it's, this is the answer. But
there are times you can kind of prompt them a little bit. Like if you happen to be standing next to an athlete as you're watching this go down, you can do the old shifty, put the hand over the mouth and just to say, hey, is there any chance you can jump in here and, you know, maybe you fix it for them? You know the answer to this? Like you can lead them down that path a little bit, I feel like, as a coach, where you still get your say, but now it's more meaningful coming from a peer.
Well, and that also helps to build leaders as well. So if you've got an athlete that, you know, is a natural leader just by nature, then, you know, that's the one that you pick. Yep. And you get them to, you know, start feeling comfortable with the fact, especially, I know I say this a lot, but especially on the girl side, they're less likely to tell anybody else what to do because of the way that that's then perceived and or received and perceived. So, you know, giving them the answer a little bit and getting them to fix it helps build and letting them know that that's okay in this environment. It really helps build leadership as well.
Yeah, got to double click on a couple of those because they're so good.
Here we go.
Yeah. the leadership space, like coaches really invest and enjoy developing leaders. And it doesn't have to be a seminar on leadership. It's, you know, how many times do we ask a question to a group of athletes and then 3 or 4 just mumble? And then we just kind of give up and then we give them the answer like what Zoe was talking about. It's like, hang on, no. Yeah, let's go back to school, hand up. Okay, we'll step forward, use a leadership voice, own the environment, give us your answer. Now, if they're wrong, that's okay. We've created a safe space, but we're giving them that confidence and that ability to step in front of people and communicate. And that's a huge part of it. So I think that's a big one. Then the other one too, and this is an area I'm really invested in at the moment in my own coaching, and I would extend it to especially our more kind of maybe senior or elite coaches that listen to the pod, and there's lots, and we thank you for listening because you can, you know, consistently showing a growth mindset. But what sort of a question asker are you? So, you know, like when Zoe gave her example, then I think she used maybe 6 words and then it was like, you know, and then kind of question mark. And that's what we want to be. We want to have really, really good open-ended questioning technique. So can I use 6 words instead of 12? Can I use all our terminology instead of mixing the terminology to confuse? So any coaches are at that point of, you know, kind of maybe feeling a little bit stagnant around, you know, their own development, you know, kind of watching the same film over and over and those sorts of things, that would be my challenge to you is go and work out how you can be a better question asker.
Yep, I like that a lot. So on that, I'll ask you a question, Coops. How do you deal with a parent that is lovely to your face but manipulative behind your back?
I rest on my stoic practices. If the parent's behavior is directly affecting the team, maybe their child's performance or how their child is interacting, and obviously that's coming through different channels, you know, I'm getting some hard evidence of how the athletes are behaving and then I'm seeing some links, that would probably have to be a conversation, you know, and we've spoken a lot on the pod around the best systems around having those conversations and what the do's and don'ts. So probably don't really need to rehash. If it's more just their personality and they like, you know, being that kind of person, smile at your face and chase you behind your back, I can't control them. Like I would not give that person energy. I don't need to. If that's how you want to live your life, it's pretty sad.
Yep. Don't disagree with that at all. Yeah. Zoe?
Well, I think I've said, and it's a somewhat unpopular opinion, but I've said it on the pod before, as a general rule, I keep parents at arm's distance, and it's for that exact thing. It's you don't know which ones are doing that. You don't know which ones aren't. You don't know which ones. I've had parents who were just the most wonderful people to me while I was coaching their daughter, and then as soon as I couldn't do anything for them anymore, they wouldn't even, you know, break if I was crossing the road. You know, like it was.
It's not just parents that have that opinion of you, Zoe. There's a few others out there as well.
Yeah,
feel
I definitely
the same
left that open. But yeah, it's disappointing, and it can get you down, because, you know, as humans, we want to believe in people and we want to think that, you know, the best in everybody and all that sort of stuff. But unfortunately, this is a space that, to protect yourself, keeping parents at an arm's length, don't let them buy you coffees. Don't let them, you know, go above and beyond for you. You know, if you really need something, then go through your team manager. That's their job. You know, all that sort of stuff. But don't, you know, don't go to their place for dinner. Don't work out their kids on their own. You know, all that sort of stuff. Keep them at an arm's length, because all you're also really doing is making it really hard for the next coach that takes them.
Yep.
So, yeah, it might be a bit unpopular, but, yeah, keeping them – because at the end of the day, their job and their care and their worry is never going to be about you. It's always going to be about their child. That's what it should be. They're their parents. So we can't expect anything different than that.
So one of the – I'll warn you guys in advance – is one of the topics we're going to have next year is a parents podcast. Essentially, is we're going to grab a couple of parents that have potentially been through our pathways before with their children, bring them in and literally just talk about what they went through, what was good, what was bad, what were some of the most ridiculous things you heard while sitting in the stands.
Do you want me to sit that podcast out? Yeah,
we may have you in on that one, Coops.
Can I screen the parents?
Yeah, we'll give you guys a little bit of input as to who that is. But it will be around that. In all honesty, the amount of misconceptions that are out there because parents get half a story from someone else and they can forward it on to another parent who has a different part of a half of a story, and you end up with just nowhere near the truth. It's like, look, what are some of the things that parents actually need to be aware of when they sign up for basketball? That what are the things that you need to be across? How do you deal with? So that is coming next year. Awesome. As is the next part of the podcast, which is we are going to be talking to a referee next year about how we can deal with them. Because one of the questions that came in was, how do you deal with refereeing inconsistencies in game? Now, this can change from in the game, where first quarter is different to third quarter. This can change from week to week, where depending on the stadium you go to, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not great. We understand that. We've all seen the no ref, no play information that's gone out over the course. But how do you best deal with this? Coops is going to come with something stoic. So I'm going straight to you first.
Oh,
so
great.
Ian,
so
say that we know what Coops' answer is going to be here.
Look, I'll be 100% honest. There are times I've looked back and I haven't dealt with it well. You know, it's really got to me because I have a real – I did one of those
personality tests.
Personality tests. And it came back with that I have a real issue. I don't handle injustice well. And when I read it, I was like, yeah, that's why I don't handle –
Zoe's career as a judge is very much yet to be known at this stage.
Oh, but that's why I probably haven't handled it well in the past. One of the things – you know, and Coop says it a lot about controlling controllables. You know, everyone makes mistakes, including referees. At the end of the day, the call's been made. No matter what you say, it's not going to change.
But it might change the next call.
Yeah, maybe.
That's what I hear our coaches out there
and
saying.
And you know what it'll change it to? Another one on you.
Yeah, exactly. So right. How often have you been asking for 3 seconds and all of a sudden it gets called on your team? Like, it happens all the time.
I nearly named a referee. Yeah. But it's hard because you care so much and you put in so much. And, you know, I think the thing to try and remember, and it's something I've been trying to remember, is they're not doing it to get to you or, you know, anything like that. It may just be an error. You know,
Or you might be wrong.
Well,
it's the other possibility.
And that's the thing
as
too,
much as we don't want to admit it.
We look at the whose name has completely escaped me right now, but the New Zealand Breakers head coach
Modi Moore,
who made a speech in the post game
against Perth with Corey Webster.
Yeah, but New Zealand made a bit of a blunder in a post that they made about Corey Webster. And then Corey Webster's come out and
played pretty well.
Yeah. Which, good for him. Yeah, I absolutely. Think that's great.
And good for John Reilly too.
I love a bit of that. But he came out and if you haven't seen it, I'd suggest go and look at it. And there's a section in it where he says, you know, they tried to lead the player that was with him to basically, you know.
Can on the organisation a little bit. Yeah,
yeah. And he just jumped in. He said, I don't like where you're taking this. I see what you're trying to do and I don't like it. Basically, we all make mistakes and we're all going to get better from it. And it was just, it's a really, really cool little hit.
Articulates it incredibly well.
Beautifully.
And I'll be honest, and we had this conversation about it last night, surprised the heck out of us. Yeah. Because we saw him as an assistant coach last year.
His mental case.
Was out there. Like, was definitely out there, like bouncing around on the sidelines, yelling, screaming, all that sort of stuff. The way he responded to that, one, phenomenal leader.
Yeah.
Like, way to dive on that grenade and make sure that, no, we as an organisation, we're all growing. What I loved in there is, like, I missed a timeout in the third quarter.
Yes. Heading with that. Like, when he made that and he openly came out and said, I missed that timeout in the third quarter, I will learn from it and get better. And it's, we all have growth that we need to make, and that's including referees. And so I think in-game changes are difficult. We've all been in a game where it's been like a bloodbath in the first and then it gets cleaned up in the second. But we also have to be aware that that's probably always going to happen. You know, if there's high foul count in the first, then it may loosen up a little bit in the second and vice versa. So, you know, understanding that that's going to happen, being ready for it, preparing your players for it, and then also letting your players know that that's the referees are not their job at all. Take that on yourself and, you know, obviously always do it in a respectful way. A big thing for me is make sure you learn referees' names. You know, speak to them like they're humans. Don't speak to them like, you know, ref. Like, I know that would annoy me. I don't like even being called coach in a nice way, you know. So it's, you know, a big part of that sort, how that conversation's going to go stems with how you enter into it. And if you're screaming ref and yelling at them and you come with this, you know,
hostile nature, effectively,
then that's going to end poorly. Yep. Whereas right place, right time, right demeanor, call them by their name, you know, I can't guarantee that you'll still get what you want out of that, but at least you're a step further away from it going pear-shaped for you. Because at the end of the day, they are humans. And I know if someone is a jerk to me...
it's very hard to take the high road, isn't
it? It really is. Yeah. High road, you don't often see me taking the overpass. So it's something that we can control as coaches and need to be better at across the board.
Yep. Coops.
Winning and losing. When you get your head around that, you know, this kind of almost devil on your shoulder that, you know, because we have winners and losers. We play a sport, a competitive sport, and the higher you go, it's more about it. I think that's where the connection with the referee starts to deteriorate. Because you're starting to look for reasons as to why we are winning or losing and, you know, especially if I don't have control over the game, that sort of thing. So once you can get your head around that and start putting winning and losing out of the equation and start caring more about your growth mindset, caring more about the enjoyment of your athletes, caring more about are we getting better? Are we getting better tonight? What do we need to work on? What can I change as a coach? Rather than investing in the referees, you're going to put yourself in a much better position. And I've only had, in my senior coach, I've only had one tech foul and it was horrible. Like I definitely didn't deserve it. I really.
He's let it go, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Stoicism.
Just because what Zoe was talking about has been something that I have tried to do is be respectful and cordial and all those sorts of things to the referees. And we had some hard times, especially my last 2 years senior coaching, because we had such a, you know, young team, low talent team. There wasn't really anyone on the floor that the referees respected, you know, that deserved calls or those sorts of things that we know creep in, you know, once the money starts coming out. And that made life tough. You know, we weren't getting calls. And so dealing with the referees wasn't really an issue because, again, I'm going to control the controllables. I don't really control them, and we've just discussed all the reasons why. It was more about the athletes and controlling their frustrations and especially them looking at me as and in like, why aren't you arguing with a referee? Why aren't you arguing to get me a call? And having the conversations in the moment around, I'm not going to do that. That's futile. I'm going to wait. That's me wasting energy, like you sitting on the bench wasting energy around worrying about me and the officials or just the officials. Like, let's worry about the game. Let's worry about what's in our control. What are you seeing that maybe we can adjust to help get us back to a more successful area of the game?
Yep. No one here is suggesting it's going to be easy, coaches. Well, we understand it. And to be fair, from a referee's perspective, we know the same – like, we've all done it as coaches. We see the refs walk towards and they go, oh, not them. Like, but if you think
and the refs are probably doing the same thing.
Yeah, refs doing exactly the same thing. If we've been a jerk to them one week and they walk into our game the next week, you can't imagine that's going to go well. But, I mean, one thing I do try and get across to coaches, anytime I do a coaching course, go and do a referee's course as a coach. Like, actually understand what it's like on the other side and what you have to go through and some of the things. Like, I know the first time I ever reffed a game, I'm sitting there with a whistle around my neck going, oh, that's a travel. I have to blow my whistle. Like, that's my job. Like, you trying to take yourself out of that sort of fan mode, I suppose, and into a position where you actually have to do something is actually difficult to do. And a lot of our referees can't start until they're 14 or 15 years old in the first place. So by the time that we get them on games, you know, they're the equivalent, and I don't say this in any way disrespectfully, they're the equivalent of an under 10 or under 12 athlete. Like, they just haven't been doing it long
enough.
They haven't been doing it long enough to get up to know that's how that needs to be called. This is how I need to deal with this situation. And we certainly don't expect perfection from our under 10 and our under 12 athletes. Like, we live in that world where we want errors, we want them to make mistakes, but we want them to learn from it. So it is a two-way street with this. Like, I'm not going to suggest I've been an angel the entire time, because I certainly haven't, but it is something that, much like everyone else, we're all trying to get better at it. Like, I don't think anyone goes out there and goes, yes, I get to yell at referees tonight. Like, no one is going in there with that mindset. But it is something that we do have to be very mindful of as well. So only got a couple of questions to go. How do you stop focusing on the result of the shot when developing technique with athletes or trying to improve their technique? And this kind of came from a, how do you improve it? What's the balance of improving a shot versus maintaining a shot? Like, how do you go from necessarily good to great in that space, Coops?
We touched on it briefly in our shooting pod, and I think Bestie kind of framed it so well from Professor Gorman. Highly recommend coaches going back and listening to the shooting pod. Bestie spoke about Professor Gorman and how his checklist relates to developing shooters, and there's some wonderful information in there. So, yeah, highly recommend. Just jump back into that pod and you'll get your answer.
Yep. So?
I think it's a big part of it, especially for youth, is consistency in your reaction. So they take the right shot at the right time with the right technique and it airballs. The one time you pull a face, you put your head in your hands, you get angry at it, that's it. They're not going to do it again. It's done. Your consistency in your response needs to be championing, you know, cheerleading, all that sort of stuff, showing why you want to see that again and again and again and again until eventually it hits. And then when it hits, making a big deal about that too. So I think, and use it again, particularly in girls, you know, you only get one time to make that error and it's over. You make that error and you've lost them. The work you're going to have to put in again to get them back to where you had them is going to be huge. So I think, yeah, it's really important to be the face they need to see when they take that shot, probably miss that shot, as long as it's the right shot. And it's like any shot, really, and when we're not even just technique. We've got to do a better job as a coaching cohort of writing the story in the air. So the shot is a good shot, whether it goes in or not, as it's being taken. Not whether it's make or miss.
Yep.
And I think sometimes, you know, I see a lot of coaches on Friday nights and it just makes me a little uneasy. Kid will take a one pass in their offense, catch and shoot, semi-contested three. It goes in and everyone's happy about it, including the coach. They take the same shot maybe one or two possessions later, the exact same shot, and it misses, and now coach is on their butt saying, hey, that's not the right shot. No. But hold on, a couple of possessions ago, it was the right shot simply because it went in.
And you make one, there's a reasonable chance you're taking a second.
Of course.
Yeah. Like it's why wouldn't from you? The player's mentality perspective, of course that's going to happen.
Yeah. So consistency in messaging with shooting in general, I think, is really important.
Well, just shifting the focus.
Yeah.
It's not about the, as much as we want it to be about the make and the miss. Like the shot type you take obviously matters, but if you are developing the athlete, get them comfortable with missing shots, because that's part of developing a shooter's mentality, is that there are nights where you're just going to miss.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and if, but if you can keep everything focused and consistent across the board, well, you're half a chance. Going back to my Skill Act conference that I went to last week, though, there was a quote in there, and I have to dig it out, about Rafael Nadal was talking about he's never hit the same shot twice because everything leading up to that point has never been the same as it has been, whether it be like two sets earlier, they haven't sprinted around, so they don't have the same level of fatigue. The ball's coming at a different velocity. They're playing at a against a 5 foot six athlete versus a 6 foot six athlete, so it's coming in at a different angle with different spin on it, and so he has to go at a different sort of time to hit the ball. Was really interesting is that sometimes we need to be okay with the messy taking shots, like, because sometimes you will have to get a shot up at the end of a shot clock or late game situation where it is contested. It's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be the ideal shot. We have to be okay with our players taking it.
Oh, 100%.
That's what it is.
Like in every drill, I'll always have a, especially if it's like a one-on-one or something like that, I'll always have a dribble max, you know, because otherwise you just see them, the big backing down the poor guard into the, you know, with 20 dribbles. So there's a dribble max, and there's always times where they've killed their dribble and they pick it up and they go, oh, and it's always find a shot. You've got to find a shot, and it's always ugly and it's always, you know, a prayer. But exactly what you're saying, it needs to be included, because sometimes that's all you can get. Shot clock and game clock running down, that might be all you can get. So if we can get comfortable shooting that shot as well, then, you know, it becomes a bit easier for us in those situations.
On the back of that too, you know, we discussed in the shooting pod around a decision prior to the shot, a decision prior to the catch, that in a game, every single shot is, you know, preceded by a decision on whether to shoot the ball or not based on the data that they've scanned. And so every shooting activity that coaches are doing should try and create some sort of decision prior. It's only going to make them better shooters in the end.
Yep, really like it. All right, a couple of sort of rapid-fiery ones that won't take a great deal of time to get through. Coos, when would you start having a captain of the team? And do you keep it the same all the time, or do you rotate it around a little bit?
I like to have multiple leaders earlier on. Probably not till under-18s, probably even youth league, to start have more of a captain and maybe a leadership group based around personalities and their ability to impact their peers.
Yep. Zoe?
Yeah, I don't think, you certainly don't need it in under-14s and below. I think that's just a recipe for disaster, to be honest, because kids don't know how to make those, deliver those messages in the right way yet. So I think, yeah, 18s, I think it depends on the team. So if it is, a VJBL team, then if you've got a leadership group, share it around. If you're in a state team, for example, where it needs to be, you know, consistent and things like that, well, then I'd keep that the same.
Is there any merit behind you've already got a really great leader, but you know a different player will really love the responsibility and bring out a little bit more of them to be the captain, so you don't give your natural leader the captaincy, so to speak? You give it to the other player and, the, you know, two aces. It's that kind of thing. Like, is there something to that, Coops, or would you still just go with the person that is the best leader in that space?
Yeah, there is. There's merit around creating a leader, like creating another leader, not just relying on the leader that's already there and has some of that natural ability. Yeah, then also just the process around that is, you know, have the discussion with the natural leader and say, hey, look, we're actually going to, you know, give this player the captaincy because we want to, you know, help build this ability. It's going to give them confidence. You know they're going to love it. They're going to be great around the team with this role. But a lot of the time, the guys are going to look to you. So can you find ways to help him grow and build, you know, some of the skills that you already have? So I think there's big merit in it, but sometimes it'll come with some processes and some conversations.
Yep, makes a lot of sense. Best penalties you use at training sessions?
So mid-training, generally try and make whatever the skill is that they've made the error on a penalty. Obviously, shooting, I'm not going to then send them and get them to shoot more because they love shooting. But, you know, if it's something on the defensive end, then they're going to have to maybe do some defensive slides. They might have to wall sit a little bit, you know, all those sort of things. Like, make the skill the penalty to really encourage, okay, next time, especially if it's defensive, that none of them want to do any of those. At the end of practice, you know, if we've done a free throw, got to make X amount, my girl seems to really enjoy, and some of your boys too, Coops. I've made some penalties that are linked with animals, so they get to pick an animal, and then it's like more an S&C or a flexibility or a, you know, more a body work than an actual, you know, penalty as so such.
Bear crawls,
crab walks, yeah. Turtles, you know, all of the above, caterpillars. They love it. They don't love it. But it's more more working on the body and working on areas of them physically that, you know, I got to be honest, I don't see any merit in running what is horribly named suicides. I just think they are a waste of time. and your kids are like, yeah, okay, you're running up and down. I get that. But if you're going to make them run up and down, put a ball in their hand or something, you know, make it a little bit more, a bit more game-like. Or yep. Yeah, or just something, because at the end of the day, that's just going to make them hate basketball.
Yep. Coops, so, what about you?
It doesn't get much better than that. Yep. The other one I'd add is one star jump.
Yeah. Geez, that's annoying, isn't it? Like, just for nuisance value more than anything else.
That's the, it. Like, pleasure in your face just then. Like, yes.
Like, I always laugh.
That was like his origin story. Oh, yeah,
it, it always cracks me up when there are coaches that say, oh, you've lost the shooting drill, so you're going to do push-ups, and then we're going to do another shooting drill. And it's like, yeah, how do you think they're going to shoot the ball after those push-ups?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's fool's gold.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, okay, yeah. They've done push-ups, but they're not going to shoot it any better. It's going to get worse. Like, it goes the other way. So I'll go first on this one because I think it's only fair to give you guys time to think about what your answer is going to be. What is the single biggest thing you think could make a massive change in youth basketball? So a change of some sort. Now, I've got a couple for you here. So one is the use of more coach developers in the sport. So people that can actually go in and deliver feedback from a holistic perspective to a coach, depending on what they're doing and how they're doing it. It might be along the communication. It might be, can you tweak this drill? It might be something just to keep people at bay and just support the coach and give a little bit of mentoring. So I think that can make a massive difference because we all understand it. Coaches are overworked and they're volunteers at the best of times. But it's probably not a director of coaching type job, but I think there's a middle ground in there somewhere where we can use coach developers that potentially don't want to go through the arduous up and down of a season. We don't want to lose them from the sport altogether, but can we bring them in to help out coaches? So that is one area from mine. The other area is bio banding in terms of how we separate out our age groups in particular. So there's a great, and I'll throw it in the show notes, there's a great video from US Soccer, of course, just keep you on topic, about how they separate out their age groups in particular. So it's not necessarily 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s as an example. They do a little bit of work about what is their percentage of physical maturation. Are they an adult at 14, in which case they can probably go and play with the older athletes, or are they simply one of the underdeveloped kids that hasn't gone through puberty yet that can, you know, that is going to be a very good athlete that just isn't getting the love they need at the moment because they get put in a third or a fourth team because they're just not physically ready to play at that level. But their IQ is pretty good and their skill set's pretty good. So we all know in basketball we do tend to favour the early developers, which is unfortunate. We've got to try and find a way of doing that. I do feel like biobanding could help us in that space. Whether it's an add-on, like I'm not suggesting we scrap all of our competitions, like, and I hear the administrators out there going, you want me to put the under-14s through to under-18s all in the one competition?
Yes.
Not happening? Yeah. Good luck. But it's something you have to do in that space that maybe there's something that we can do as a Basketball Victoria type space. Could we have, I don't want to say like a second nationals because I don't want to go down that path, but is there something that we could do? And I suppose we kind of have it to a degree with things like Academy and SDP. We do pick up a few of the long-term athletes that aren't ready necessarily straight away and try and keep them involved for as long as we can. But I do think there's something in that space that we can do for our athletes around the physical maturation so that we don't have just the early developers dominate in 12s and 14s, which is a space that, you know, doesn't usually result in 16s and 18s and senior success. So I do think it will keep kids in the sport because they have a more relevant game-like experience where they're just not getting beaten down by some kid that's gone through puberty and is shaving in under 12s. They're just not ready for that. Like, it's that is an area I think we can have a look at. I don't know how. If anyone's got any ideas, I'm happy to hear them. In particular, if you want to put together like a business case, like that'd be fantastic if you want to do that for us. But that is something I do feel like we could potentially do to maybe keep our kids in the sport, because I think it's going to be a more enjoyable experience for them. But I also think they're going to improve a lot out of that as well. Zoe, what do you got? I gave you a good run-up.
Yeah, like I know. I'd like to see, especially for our, I'm speaking probably, I suppose, more of the top-end athletes, those that are in state teams that are being dragged into senior basketball in, you know, 16s and 18s, you know, play at schools as well, so they're, you know, they're being dragged in 20 different directions. I'd really like to see a bit of an adjustment to our competition, you know, whether it be not so much a shortening of the competition, because, you know, we all know the reasons why we have to, you know, keep venues full and things like that. You know, basically we don't have enough venues as it is, we give them up. We're never going to get them back, you know. So we're all well across that. But I think allowing our athletes some time to rest, for one, but also work on their body, work on their skill set, you know, and not being dragged around to 50 different things with 50 different voices, you know. I mean, it's tough. And I know it's probably something that would never be able to be facilitated, but, yeah, that would be something I think, you know, if we could find something for our...
Just a bit of balance.
Just, yeah. More than anything else. Yep. Well, as well as to, you know, just let them be a kid. You know, the things that you have to sacrifice to be a top-level athlete, there's no question of that, but you also have to be a good son or daughter, you know, a good friend, and, you know, have those experiences too. So, and I don't think we really allow enough time for that. Yep. With everything that we've got, you know, everything they've got in their calendars. So, yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but I think, yeah, if we could find something.
Yep. Coops, what do you got?
Probably looking at a European model. Yep. Or some more specifics, I would scrap 5-on-5 basketball for under 10s. Ooh. And under 12s.
Yes.
Wow, here we go.
So 3-on-3 only. Then I would run 5-on-5 and 3-on-3 concurrently with the under 14s, and then 3-on-3 could obviously just become an option going a little bit higher.
Would you make 5-on-5 an option?
So 5-on-5 would be, you could still have that.
Okay, so yeah, both, yeah, okay, both, yeah, I've got yeah. You now. Yep.
In domestic basketball, I would remove the ladder from under 14s down. So you still have winners and losers, understand how to play the game and the scoreboard, but I'd remove the ladder. So just creating more of an enjoyable decision, skill-based structure at the bottom in terms of, not bottom, but grassroots, sorry, yeah, excuse
play
me.
Play for fun.
You play for fun.
And play for development.
Exactly. Get the ball in your hands. Like, there's no way an under 10, you know, there's too many times an under 10 kid gets in the car after a domestic game and has not touched the ball.
Yep.
And that's just
yeah.
ludicrous. So separating, and what I mean by separating is getting a clear understanding of what I'm playing domestic basketball for compared to what I'm playing elite basketball for. Then with the elite structure, it would be more around that European professional academy model. And the reason I say that is obviously that usually allows the money to be funneled more into things like what you were talking about, Rob, like coach developers. So having professionals at the club that can be around coaches more, more coaches at those academies that are paid to be full-time coaches, and then also elevating the level of who's playing in those academies and who's playing each other. And then obviously the structure going up would be similar in terms of your under 23 team going into your senior team. Yeah, that stuff works. The other thing I would do, which really follows on with what Zoe's talking about, would be tournament seasons versus full length seasons, and basically under 18s down, I'd be heavily into a tournament based season. So you have maybe 3 months where you played a number of tournaments that you know could potentially scale up or however you wanted to structure it. But then you get a really good off season, time to rest, time to work on your body. I had one athlete grow 6 inches in one of the lockdowns because the kid had just never had to rest before. It's just crazy. So having a tournament-based season, and then with the higher-level athletes starting to look at more of a structured season that would mimic their professional goals. I could keep going, but I'll leave it there.
That wraps us up. So big thanks to all the guests we've had over the course of this last season. It's amazing how many people we reach out to and say, hey, would you be interested in jumping on the podcast? Always yes. Always at really short notice. They jump in, and it's no massive surprise to people that are in that coaching space. They all help. They all volunteer. They all tip in with each other, which is always fantastic. Massive thanks to you two, and also to Bestie as well, for jumping in over the course of this last season. I think we had 14 or 15 episodes in this thing, which is obviously difficult to do in your busy schedules as well. So big thanks to you. And, of course, thanks to everyone that's written in, liked, shared, retweeted, shared the podcast and all that sort of stuff. It's certainly aimed at coaches, there's no question, but there's a whole bunch of people out there that are just fans of basketball that listen to this as well, which is kind of cool. Like, it's something a little bit different. So this is kind of the best part of our week, in all honesty, is coming in and doing the podcast stuff, and we may need to move it to a later time slot after we've had lunch so that we're not quite so cranky when we roll in first thing in the morning, but, you know, we'll look at that.
Well, and we'd be, you know, this isn't overly comfortable for me, but a big thank you to you, though, too. This is your brain baby, and it's helped so many coaches.
No, that's quite
across
right.
Across the state, across the country. Yeah. So
this is my social time every week. Other than this, I don't talk to anybody. Like, this is what podcasting is for me. So it's this is just the time I converse with people. So we will be back for a season 8 next year. We'll be looking to go a little bit earlier. We don't normally come back until like June, July. We'll come back in February-ish, I think, next year and try and go a little bit earlier. So a couple of topics, obviously, we've alluded to, something with the referees and how we can better work in with them, something with the parents, how we can better work in with them as coaches as well. If there are any other topics, please let us know. If there is anything you want in that space, Coops, I know you've already lined up a guest for us next year as well. So there's going to be a ton of new information coming out there. Coops, give us your top 3 Stoic books or podcasts. What do you got?
I'll start with Ryan Holiday, and he's got a series of books that are really fantastic just to introduce you into the philosophy.
Yep, that's probably a great space to jump into first off. So if you're not listening to our podcast, listen to his podcast. He's a really good one. So would recommend you having a little bit of a look at sort of your growth in your off season and how you can manage your work-life balance or your sport-life balance, as the case may be for most of us. Coaches, we do really appreciate your support with the podcast. Please have a safe holidays, whatever you're doing. Keep a ball in your hand, players. If you're looking to do something, don't let that fitness level just drop off the cliff completely. Please stay around it if you possibly can. Coaches, thank you very much. Good luck for your last week of grading, if that is you this week or whenever we talk to you next. And we will catch you guys on the podcast next time. Look, tune in, enjoy the tribe on iTunes and Spotify.